Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 19th of April. John Francis, who's also known as the Planet Walker, is our guest this hour. In 1971, he said he was exposed to an environmental insult of such magnitude, 400,000 gallons of oil spilling into San Francisco Bay, that he couldn't get away from it. You could close your eyes, you could turn around, but you just couldn't get away from the impact of it. The smell was overpowering. He decided at that moment that he wanted to do something, but he didn't know exactly what. He mentioned to a friend that he wanted to stop riding in cars. The friend laughed, and he laughed at himself, and that was the end of it. It wasn't until a neighbor died the next year, a person who had a wonderful life, that he realized that the only time we have to do what we need to do is right now. And so he stopped riding in motorized vehicles, and that was a vow that lasted for not just a few days, but 22 years. He also spent 17 years voluntarily silent, which I must say I can't imagine. When he was silent, he completed three college degrees. He got a PhD in land management from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and he also walked across the country and walked to South America on behalf of the environment and world peace. He's going to be speaking at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee this Wednesday at 7 o'clock about the environment and its relationship to social justice. And he is our guest this hour, John Francis. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address, as always, is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hello, John Francis. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, yeah. Our great pleasure. I was interested in reading a little bit about Earth Day. We celebrated the 40th anniversary, as you well know, that Gaylord Nelson from Wisconsin and the founder of Earth Day said the week before Earth Day that our concern about the environment must mean attacking the problems of our cities and the poor as much as it means providing national parks and scenic rivers. And I think that probably describes your mission as well, that it was about injustice as much as it is about pretty rivers, clean rivers, and parks.
Yes, and I'm going to applaud his forward thinking there. Because as I started out thinking about environment and being an activist in the environmental movement, I didn't hear much about the human connection to the environment in the sense that human rights or civil rights or economic equity was part of environmental justice. Or the environmental movement at all. So I am pleased that Gaylord thought that.
So you witnessed this horrendous oil spill. Take us back to that day, and if you had environmental concerns before that event, or how it was so overwhelming to you that you did something that was really quite dramatic.
Yeah. Well, you know, the first day that I experienced the oil spill, I think what really bothered me was the loss of wildlife with the birds, because the birds just seemed to, and the seals and the animals that were the marine animals around, they were just at a loss. They couldn't get away. I mean, they didn't know what was going on. Birds landed in oil because that's what they do. I mean, they land in the water, but the water was covered with oil, and so they would be fouled, and then they would die. There are lots of people running around trying to save the seabirds and the shorebirds, and that kind of was reminiscent of my own youth, watching a robin, for example, fall out of a nest in Philadelphia, where I was raised. And wanting to take care of that robin until it was able to fly away, which a lot of kids did in the cities. They would take in abandoned or lost birds and feed them until they were able to fly away. That was one of those things that gave us a connection to the environment. Now, the problem was with when the oil spill happened, as you mentioned, I said that I wanted to do something, and I thought right away, well, I'm driving. Maybe I should give up riding in cars. And as I said that to my friend who had gone to see the oil spill, she kind of laughed at me, and I thought, yeah, that was pretty funny. How could you live your life without riding in cars? And I thought it was like that was just a pipe dream.
Right. But then a friend died, and that also had a huge impact on you, and you decided that you had to do something. If we're going to do something, we have to do it now.
Yeah, and that, you know, the my friend who was, I lived in a very small town of about 300 people in Northern California, Inverness, and the friend was a deputy sheriff, actually, and I was a hippie. And so, you know, we were kind of at odds, a cat and mouse, you know, there, going around and round, and he was always looking in my girlfriend's yard for whatever was going there that he could confiscate. but at the very least, we were very civil to each other.
Right.
And then sometimes, you know, when in the evening when I'd be out on the road, we would actually stop and really have a serious talk about family and what we're doing and what our dreams were. So when he, in a boating accident, died, which is over a year from the oil spill, when he was lost in a boating accident, they never found him.
Oh.
His family was saved, but he was lost. And I really felt that we should go for a walk, my girlfriend and I, for a walk, to celebrate his life, and that's what we did. And it was on that walk, on the way back, we had went a 20-mile walk into the county, to San Anselmo, to hear a music group sing and play music and celebrate Jerry's life. And on the way back, I started thinking about life and death and opportunity and the moment, and that's when I realized that Jerry, who had all these wonderful things, he had a family and a house with a white picket fence around it. I mean, he was living the American dream and a good job, and just like that, like he was gone.
Yes.
And it made me understand, perhaps for the first time, that we only have this moment to do the things that we need to do or want to do or have to do, however you want to say that. But we only have this moment. We live in this moment to dream about things like, well, when I get the money, and that's what we did. We kind of put walking off that responsibility that I felt when I saw the oil spill. I put that off with the idea that, well, when I could afford to, when the money came, I would be able to afford to walk. And my girlfriend said, yeah, because, John, if you don't have any money and you're walking, people will look at you and just call you a bum, mm-hmm, or a hippie.
Right.
And if we had money and we were walking, people would say, ah, look at the rich people walk. They must know something. Now, this was way before Forrest Gump or anybody. Expect a slew of people to start walking after you, but when I came up, I said, you know, we're walking right now, and we only have this moment, and I just felt at that moment that I could just continue to walk. And so that's what I did.
That's what you did.
Yeah.
And tell me, how does somebody who speaks so beautifully and poetically decide to give up the language for 17 years, for heaven's sake?
Oh, you know, probably. Thank you so much for that compliment. but, you know, I had really a difficult time speaking before I gave up, not gave up speaking for 17 years, and I mean difficulty in the sense that I had a very I should say my language was not, it was very coarse. That's a nice way of saying that I use lots of profanity. Just how I grew up, and I always wanted to stop, but it seemed as though I couldn't do it. I just couldn't stop using words that I didn't want to use, but I just used them, and they just came out. And the other issue about speaking for me was that I wasn't very truthful when I spoke. I was always looking for a way to paint myself in whatever light that I thought that whoever I was talking to would respect me more. And so I had to say that I wasn't very truthful. An example of that, Kathleen, is I play the banjo.
Right.
But I had to learn how to play the banjo. Now, I carried the banjo with me everywhere I went when I was silent. And so if someone asked me how well I played the banjo, I would play it, and they would go, oh, so you're learning to play the banjo. But if I didn't have the banjo and someone asked me, wow, you play the banjo, and I would go, yeah, I'm looking for a record contract right now.
Uh-huh.
And I've been playing for years, but... I mean, I would just kind of embellish that to the point where you wouldn't recognize this person who is talking. So
right. And during that time, you listened, obviously, and you listened and listened, and you're walking and listening, so you were listening to all kinds of different viewpoints, et cetera. You also received several degrees, right, including a PhD in land management here in Wisconsin?
Right from UW-Madison, from the Gaylord Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies.
Oh.
Yeah. And it was, very interesting for me to go to school, but when I stopped speaking and I started walking around, I realized that I was changing. I'm writing a book right now called The Ragged Edge of Silence, which is about the silence that is always with us and how we move in and out of it. But I found myself changing. I found myself in an altered state. And I say an altered state because of just the, if you can think of it, and the synapses that we use as a physiology to speaking and a physiology to listening and hearing ourselves speak and hearing the feedback of our own voice. But when you stop speaking, over a period of time, those things, those synapses, all of that physiology is altered. It stops. You stop using that. And there is a place where you find yourself in a state where it's very different from what you would have been used to when you're talking. And so I found myself in this really altered place, and a lot of things just started coming to me that, I was painting, for one thing. I was painting every day, and I started writing a journal. And I wanted to go to school. I had gone to school earlier when I finished high school in 1964, but I tried college, and it just wasn't for me. And I dropped out, and I have to say, if you drop out of school, I want to tell any of the students who are listening, if you decide that you want to drop out of college, remember to withdraw from your classes so they don't all turn to F's.
Oh.
I didn't remember that.
Ooh.
And so when I finally went back to school, I had to deal with those things that had turned to F's, which I, when I'm speaking to college group, I'll say those F stands for foolish and follow you the rest of your life.
Right. I love the story, too. It's kind of funny when you were applying, I think it was University of Montana, when you decided to go back to school. I think you were living in California and you told the admissions officer, well, it's going to take me a while to get there because you were walking, right?
I wrote. I said, well, how long will it? They said, well, what semester do you want to start? And I said, well, it'll take me about 2 years to get there because I'm walking, you know. and they wrote back saying, okay, we'll be waiting.
Now, did you carry a sign so that people knew what you were doing? Were you making a statement in some way?
Well, you know, when I first started, I think I was carrying more than a sign. I was carrying a big chip right on my shoulder. Mm. And that was that, you know, I was doing something for the environment, and there was more of a holier-than-thou person.
Mm.
And so when people stopped to talk to me about what I was doing, it would always turn into an argument. And the silence helped me get out of that as well, the arguing part, and just to accept that I was doing this as a journey that I was on. And that I didn't think or try to persuade other people to do what I was doing. That the only thing I thought was that, you know, you should do what it is that you think is the right thing for you to do. And I didn't know what that was. I barely knew what it was for me. And so that's, you know, how I kind of went through my life during those early years. Is learning just how to be and to be happy with myself, to accept myself, and it took some years to realize that that one of the things that when I wasn't as truthful as I might have been as I was growing up, that it had a lot to do with me being African American, growing up in white America. And not having the models that I would love to have had, or just low self-esteem,
mm-hmm.
and trying to build that person up to finally being able to accept myself as just who I am, and saying, "Hey, you know, John, you're okay being just who you are. You don't have to be like anyone else or like that person. You really just need to be who you are, and that's a special person."
We're going to welcome phone calls for you. John Francis, the Planet Walker, is our guest this hour of the program. He's going to be speaking this Wednesday at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee about the environment and its relationship to social justice. He's done remarkable things in his life, including giving up motorized transportation when he saw this horrendous oil spill in San Francisco in 1971. And then he explained why he did this, also took a vow of silence that lasted for 17 years. During this time period, he went to school. He received 3 college degrees and received his PhD in land management from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send us an email, you can do that. That's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Francis, the Planet Walker, author of The Planet Walker, How to Change Your World One Step at a Time, is our guest this hour. And our number, 800-486-8655. We start our calls with Jeff from Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
I'm really curious about your guest's opinion about the barrels in Lake Superior. You know, 50 years ago, our government, under contract apparently with Honeywell or something like that, dumped these barrels in Lake Superior, which contained munitions and possible radioactivity. I wonder how he feels about preserving our Great Lakes and clean water, and how he feels maybe we can address that issue in the 21st century.
Well, that's a big question, John.
Well, that is a big question. And, of course, I feel horrible about that. and that our government would do that, or that anyone would do such a thing. I don't know the technical answer to how we clean that up, but I think it's something that we're going to just have to address and have a cleanup. But I don't know about that problem specifically. But yeah, I feel very strongly that we shouldn't do things like that. One of the things came to after walking across the country and studying environment was that we do a lot of things to the environment that if we had really cared and thought about each other. So I'm looking at what I believe the foundation of true environmentalism is to understand that it's really about how we treat each other, how we treat ourselves, and how we treat each other. So it's about, you know, not only pollution, but human rights and civil rights and gender equality and economic equity, so that if we understood what we were doing, if, for example, the industry or the government says, well, look, we're going to just dump these things here, and we know that it's going to hurt us or some people later on, but we don't have to think about them. Well, that's really not caring about each other. I'm thinking if we do care about each other, we wouldn't do those things in the first place. Now that we have done those things, of course, we're going to have to figure out a way to clean them up. I mean, that's the short of it.
Thank you, Jeff, for the call. Tell me about the work that you did with the Coast Guard, John.
Well, in fact, at Madison, when I studied for my PhD, my dissertation was on oil spills and oil spills in the marine environment. And my colleagues told me at the time that, John, no one was really interested in oil spills, but that was just before I finished my final examinations, and that was in March of 1989, and Exxon Valdez happened.
Oh.
And everyone was interested in oil spills.
Yes.
People were calling the University of Wisconsin to talk to this guy who was studying oil spills at a PhD level. It turned out to be me. I didn't answer the phone, of course, because I didn't talk, but it turned out I was the only one in the United States studying oil spills at that level. And I finished writing my dissertation and started speaking in Washington on the 20th anniversary of Earth Day. And my major professor at Madison was so pleased. He said, this is a very important time for you to do this. My committee, they were kind of shocked that I could speak in sentences because none of them had heard me speak.
Oh, my goodness.
While I was going to school. And I figured, oh, my goodness, all I needed to do was say a couple of sentences and they would give me a PhD. That was just a joke, though, Kathleen.
I know.
My dissertation was read by people in government, and I was recruited by the U.S. Coast Guard, the Oil Pollution Act of 1990, to help write the regulations for oil pollution, oil transportation, and oil spills in the marine environment in the United States. And I have to tell you, I was just, I'm still, even now, I was flabbergasted at the idea that I started walking in 1972, and then walked someone. If someone had said, John, if you walk east, you know, and if you shut up, get out of your car, walk east, and don't say anything, you're going to make a difference. And 20 years later, I find myself in Washington, D.C. with a Ph.D. in environmental studies from Madison and the Gaylord Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies. And there I am writing the regulations for the United States. You know, I would not have believed them.
No, it is rather flabbergasting, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is flabbergasting.
But that's the kind of journey I think that we're all on, that we, as you know, with our intention to do good for all of us, that we find a way to do that, even though we don't know it and we might not see it at the time.
What do you think? Think of somebody now who may have seen something, maybe is very, very concerned about global warming, which is an issue that we care about, and we forget about it for a while, and then we care about it for a while. It's been described so many as by so many as the issue of our time. If you were walking now, and I think you probably wouldn't have 20 years to accomplish this, what would be on the other side of that walk right now? Would it be a worldwide treaty that would limit carbon emissions by a certain percentage, or what would it be?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I always try to stay within myself, and so I would, you know, I could say start talking about a treaty, which I think, well, gee, that would be great. That would, you know, if we had a treaty, that would be good, and that would be international, and people all over the world would start working toward that. But here and right now, I can tell you maybe that's going to happen. You know, maybe that will happen. But right now, I'm working with solar energy companies, and a solar energy company in particular. But because of the incentives now for developing solar energy, there is a program where, and I won't mention the company's name, so I just want it to be understood that there are programs now where you can, a homeowner, just sign a lease agreement and have a company put on solar panels for your home, to your home, reduce your energy bill by 80%, put the whole system in, and so you're only paying 20% of what your energy bill was, and you're into the solar, you know, you're into the solar arena now.
Right.
And you're selling solar energy on the grid back. It's going back into the grid, back to the energy companies, which are now getting mandated to produce so much energy through renewable resources, and getting penalized if they don't. So they're kicking in some states, they're kicking in a certain amount of money as an incentive for homeowners to do this. So in the end, the homeowner's not paying anything but paying less.
Goodness.
And having solar panels on their home.
And is this pretty widespread?
Well, I live in New Jersey right now. I'm in Cape May, New Jersey, and I think New Jersey is one of the top states, along with Massachusetts, that gets the maximum amount of incentive. And so it's just incredible. I was just this weekend with a state senator and some people from the energy company in Synergy, who were there celebrating for the first business in the whole state to use solar panels to reduce their energy cost, but also to help with the climate change issues. And if you can imagine that this program will be in, you know, thousands and thousands of homes now can buy into this without having to spend any money, without having to put any money out, I think it's a terrific opportunity for people in the United States right now.
It certainly is. Let's go back to the walk for a moment, because it's such an extraordinary thing. You were confronting, I'm sure, you were talking, we're talking about some years here when, well, there always have been, but there have been some racial tensions in this country that have been quite extraordinary. Here you are, an African-American male with a banjo, walking across, you know, the country and not speaking, for heaven's sake. And yet, from what I've read, you were welcomed pretty warmly by people of many political persuasions. What does that say?
Well, you know, I think it says a lot. not to say that there were not and are not still racial tensions in America, but it does say that maybe they're not as bad as they might have been, and maybe there's opportunity for us to really get together on this. I mean, look at who's president now.
I mean, yes.
That's a huge step. And not to say that it's, you know, because there's an African-American president that he's better or worse than anyone, but that the fact that we can have that speaks volumes to the progress that we've made in America.
I agree with you. I think that it does speak volumes about the progress we've made. And there is something I'm still struck by, the way he has come from so many parts of the world. Yeah, I just think that's quite remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
Quite remarkable. Where did you stay? Did people just invite you to come into their homes? Or?
Oh, that's very interesting, because most of the times I slept out. I mean, I had
my
backpack, and I, you know, had a tent and sleeping bag, and sometimes I would sleep under bridges, or, you know, sometimes I would just sleep by the side of the road, and if I was walking through a wilderness area, I would sleep in campsites or just wherever. But there were many times when I'd be walking from one town to another, and it might take me 3 or 4 days to get from one town to the next town. When I got to that town, there'd be so many interactions I would have with people on the way, where people would stop and ask me if I wanted a ride, or they would see me walking for like 3 days, and they say, "That guy is walking for 3 days, but look, he's playing a banjo." You know, they would stop and ask if I had played something on the banjo, and by the time I got to the next town, I would, you know, be looking forward to a nice breakfast, perhaps at a cafe, and I would go in and I'd sit down, and the waitress would come over and said, "You know, breakfast has been paid by somebody 5 days ago."
Oh,
you know, they saw you
walking.
And sometimes I would get to places, and then people would say, "Well, you know, we've been looking for you for several days now, waiting for you to get here, because the Chamber of Commerce wants you to, you know, they have a hotel for you that they're
oh my goodness
doing things like that." People would invite me to dinner, and little kids especially would say, "Could you come to my house?" and, you know, depending on how this felt, I would find myself in, you know, some walking to somebody's house and, you know, hoping for the best, and really being surprised at the warmth with which I was received.
But you didn't talk, so how did you communicate?
You're right, I didn't talk. I forgot about that.
Right.
Well, the one thing I think that was really helpful was the banjo and music. That was, you know, can remember being in a number of houses. I would, you know, act out mime, and I had newspaper clippings of where I had been. And once I got to a town, somebody wanted to write a story, and that went to the next town. And so people kind of had an idea who I was. I had also little cards. If I had been, like when I started from a school or something, I'd put together a little card that said what I was doing and where I was going and why I was doing it. And I would give those to people. So those kind of went out ahead of me as well. But the music was a big draw. Sometimes I would be at someone's house, and they would dial up their friend on the telephone, and they'd say, Bert, you seen that boy walking down the road? Yep, that one with the banjo? Guess who's here at our house?" "Go ahead, play that banjo." And I play the banjo, and they said, "Yeah, he sure can play."
Oh, my.
And, he's got to leave. He's got to leave tomorrow. He's on the road, you know. And next, the kids would want me to come to their school for show and tell.
I'll bet. You'd be a great show and tell.
It was, you know, pretty wonderful.
Oh, yeah. Let's go to a couple more callers. Sarah from Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Sarah.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I'm still inspired by the time I saw you speak at the Aldo Leopold Foundation several years ago, and so I was excited you're on the radio. I have a question. We have great opportunity right now with the growing local foods movement around the country and especially in Wisconsin. And I'm wondering kind of what your thoughts are on that and also maybe some of the social justice issues around food that we need to be paying attention to as this grows.
Wow. Well, thank you very much for remembering my words at the Aldo Leopold Center there. That was a good time for me. And I also want to say that I will be in Madison, I guess that's tomorrow, at about 1 o'clock, speaking at the Gaylord Nelson Institute 40th anniversary celebration of Earth Day.
Okay.
And now about food. Well, food is and local food it's just an important thing to really take control of what we eat. If we can do that, that would be a tremendous advance in our own health, not only in our mental health for being able to grow our food, seeing where it comes from and knowing how it's grown, but just in being able to address those issues, which the issues of human rights and civil rights and environmental justice of labor and how we treat the people who grow our food now. Migrant labor is such an important issue because it comes under those things of human rights, civil rights, economic equity, and how we treat each other when we meet each other is really the whole philosophy that we need to incorporate into our environmental ethic.
Thank you so much for your call, Sarah. Dan from Duluth is next. Hi, Dan.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm calling to say to John, thanks for it's a remarkable life. I remember hearing you speak on the radio again. I think it was back in the winter of 1986 or 87, I was living in a little cabin in northern Minnesota and only had the radio for information. And remember you because of the Planet Walker moniker, I guess. And I just wanted to say your story was, I found it inspiring then, and I find it to be inspiring again today, almost 25 years later.
Oh, that's great.
And you know, it's a constant struggle to find ways to feel like you're having a positive impact on the world, and you've certainly found creative ways to do that, and thanks again.
Well, thank you, and I hope it was actually 1990 that you heard me speak, because that's when I started speaking again, in 1990, but those four, I'm sure that's probably when it was, because I can hardly remember the dates of things that have happened to me. But those dates are kind of ingrained in there. But what I really want to say is that, you know, we all have this ability, because we're all on this journey. And we learn and we teach each other. We learn from each other and we teach each other. When I was at University of Montana, I was a teaching assistant, and I led a discussion group, and I didn't speak. My students were just kind of there with their mouths hanging open when I first was introduced as their new TA. But sooner or later, it was a few days later, we were all just so engrossed in, you know, what we were learning. I would make some sign, some mime, and the students would gather around, and they would say things like, oh, I think he's talking about clear cutting. No, he was using a handsaw. He must be talking about selective forestry, because you couldn't clear cut with a handsaw. And the argument, well, yes, you could do that with a handsaw. Well, sometimes I would make signs, and I meant nothing about what it was that the students came back with, but I realized that I should have meant that, and I realized how much I was learning from my students, and I left that experience understanding and feeling that if you were teaching and not learning, you probably weren't doing such a great job teaching. And I believe that firmly, that we are learning from each other and teaching each other all the time. So all the little things that we do that we think, oh, well, you know, I'm just doing this in my own little world and it's not really making a big impact, everything we do makes an impact on each other. We all learn and teach. It's just amazing how it works.
So I must ask, of course, what prompted the first words? And you must remember, because they were pretty important after 17 years of no words. What were they?
Well, the first words were, thank you for being here.
Oh, how nice.
And it was because of, like, you know, understanding that it really takes more than one person for there to be communication. That there has to be someone to receive the message and to respond to that. So in Washington, D.C., on the 20th anniversary of Earth Day, I first started speaking. And I chose Earth Day because, well, every year on my birthday, I would stop and reflect, and that's in February. I would stop and reflect, does this silence still work? Is it still appropriate? And it took 17 years before I got to the place where I said, you know, it's time to start speaking again. And the reason I started speaking was, which I've been saying all this morning, was because I had a message that was different than when I started out learning about environment. And that message was, it was important about pollution. It was important about climate change and loss of species and loss of habitat. But equally as important, and perhaps even more important, was how we treated ourselves and how we treated each other, and that we absolutely needed to treat ourselves with respect and dignity and love and in a way that was nurturing to all of us, because that was what was going to manifest in the physical environment around us. And so I chose Earth Day to speak because I wanted to remind myself that when I did speak, I wanted to speak for the environment. And that environment, to me, had changed to be about not only those things, but also about people and how we treated each other.
John Francis is our guest this hour. And he is the author of Planet Walker, How to Change Your World One Step at a Time. He's an environmentalist, a goodwill ambassador for the UN Environment Program. He spent 22 years not being in a motorized vehicle as the result of seeing a horrendous oil spill in San Francisco in 1971. And as you just heard him say, spent 17 years voluntarily silent. He has his PhD in land management from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And he's going to be, in celebration of Earth Day, speaking tomorrow at 1 o'clock in Madison at the Gaylord Nelson Institute. And he's going to be speaking at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee at 7 o'clock on Wednesday, talking about the environment and its relationship to social justice. More phone calls in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our next caller is Jean from Wauwatosa. Hi, Jean.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for another wonderful show. I always find I have something that sparks my interest. And this morning we were walking to school, my 8-year-old son and I, and we had just been at the cottage up north near Shawano over the weekend, and he asked me when we were walking to school how long it would take to walk to the cottages. And so we calculated it out as we walked, and I just thought maybe he'll be inspired like your guest.
How long would it take?
Quite a while.
Quite a while.
40 miles.
Uh-huh.
So we talked about whether we would walk at night and how we would eat and what we would, you know, would we be carrying water, et cetera. So another good walk to school with my son.
Oh, what a great walk to school, wasn't that, John?
Yeah, that's wonderful. I walked my son to school this morning as well, and we were talking about walking, which we do often, and actually this Earth Day, the 22nd, I will be in Columbus, Ohio, to continue my walk across the United States, back from the East Coast to the West Coast.
Oh, my.
And on that walk, I'm developing. I started this one in 2005 after I had walked the length of South America. And I wanted to do this because I wanted to develop this curriculum called Planet Lines based on walking, the walking journey, where students K through university could gather data, whether it was quantitative data, environmental data, looking at temperatures and humidity and soil moisture and water quality, those kinds of things, and also the qualitative data of painting and writing a journal and interviewing people and poetry and how this place makes you feel, and putting all that together in a line, which is on a GIS format, which would be on our website. And I'm now a fellow, actually, at National Geographic, education fellow there.
Oh.
And we're working to develop this together. So they'll bring it out once we have it. But every year I work on that. And my son, who's 9 years old, will be coming out and walking with another 9-year-old for a few days to help us develop that for middle school. And in Madison, I'll be walking with about 134 seventh graders on the 21st, before I get to go to Milwaukee, at the Black Hawk School District. They'll be from the Black Hawk School District, and we'll be walking in Madison, developing that program as well, the curriculum called Planet Line. So that's something that's really important, to get our students out of the classroom and into the classroom that is the environment around all of us. And that's what we're doing.
It's wonderful. Thanks, Gene, for the call. Dick from Waukesha. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen and John.
Hey,
hi, Dick.
Hi, Dick.
I live alone. I'm an old geezer. And I talk to myself quite often, especially when I do something dumb. Did you ever make a slip and talk to yourself?
Well, actually, I'm probably an old geezer too. But when I started my silence, there were a couple of times, and I wrote about them because they were just so. Some of them were so humorous, I had to write them down. When I hadn't been used to not speaking, and I would blurt out with something. And once I was watching a television set in a motel, and I was watching the Ten Commandments, and Charlton Heston had raised his hands as he's playing Moses, spread his hands, and the Red Sea parted, and this was before all the special digital effects, and you know, most incredible thing, and Pharaoh's men went rushing across into the Red Sea, and the seas crashed down on him. And I went, "Oh my God!" And I went, "Oh, did I say that?" I thought it was pretty impressive to me.
Oh, that's great! Thank you, Dick.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Hi, Dick.
Thanks very much for your call. Well, darn, we're out of time. Well, I am so happy you're speaking again, John.
Me too.
And thank you for being here. It was a really good hour. Have fun in Wisconsin. And with this week, what a week you're going to have.
Yeah.
Oh, wonderful. John Francis, our guest this hour, environmentalist, goodwill ambassador for the United Nations Environmental Program. He's an education fellow for National Geographic. and has just a remarkable story. He does have a book. It may be a little hard to get, but you can certainly learn more about it on the web. Planet Walker, How to Change Your World One Step at a Time. He's speaking at the Gaylord Nelson Institute tomorrow in anticipation of the 40th anniversary of birthday as well, I guess. That's at 1 o'clock tomorrow. And then he's going to be at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. He won't have time to walk those distances, I don't think, but he will be speaking 7 o'clock this coming Wednesday about the environment and his relationship to social justice. If you didn't get that, we'll post that on our website as soon as we're done here, Facebook page, actually. So go to the Kathleen Dunn Show and we'll give you more info. Give us a few minutes to get it posted there. Well, thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour and to John Treader for on-air production and for all of your calls. Thanks, everybody. I'll be with you again tomorrow at 9 o'clock. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Great conversations ahead here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.